Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally, 7 days a week, here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on questions and answers we'll start with right after this message. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state, and like any other state-sponsored enterprise, it's regulated, and it's regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, the Family Court, the legislature. You know, the best part about it all is that you don't have any input into or say-so over the marriage, the divorce, the dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders, but you get to pay for all of it. And if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important and the most expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know a whole lot less about it than you do your military obligation or your house payments. Now, 67%, that's two-thirds of all marriages here in the United States, end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or defend against a breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of that marriage contract before you marry. And you should write that contract yourself instead of letting the state write it for you. Now, whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my free general law CD package and let me share some vital information with you about the law and that marriage contract. To order yours, just call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. That free CD set is a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email, and then send an email request. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, from time to time, I get a letter in here, and sometimes people compliment me and tell me that I'm walking on water, and other times they'll write me a letter and correct me and say, you know, you're as dumb as a box of rocks. Well, I'll get a couple of letters here that I thought I'd share with you so that I could correct my errors. Joanna writes a letter, and she says, at a little past 5 a.m. this morning, 1-19-05, your program was broadcast through a micro station in Austin, Texas, and shortly after I tuned in, I heard you speaking on the 12 days of Christmas, those days being December 24th through January the 6th. However, you informed your listeners that the 12 days of Christmas commenced on December the 21st, the winter solstice. Now, I've attended many church services in those churches that follow a calendar of the church year, Roman Catholic, Episcopal, and Lutheran. And I can assure you that the 12 days of Christmas have always been December the 24th through January the 6th. Many of the churches that I have mentioned hold their first services of Christmas starting just about midnight, December the 24th. January 1st commemorates the circumcision of Jesus Christ, and January the 6th commemorates the visit of the Magi, who were guided by a star to the Christ child. Well, Mr. Gordon, even our one daily newspaper here does not know when the 12 days of Christmas are, even though their address is within a short distance of the Roman Catholic Cathedral and the largest Episcopal church, a church that follows the same church calendar as the Roman Catholic Cathedral that's within walking distance. The newspaper staff seems to think those 12 days begin on December the 13th to promote, no doubt, shop, shop, shop. Well, those days of Christmas have always meant very much to me, and so I hope you don't mind my telling you that the winter solstice has nothing to do with the 12 days of Christmas. Most sincerely, Joanna, Austin, Texas. And she went on to say that there are four Sundays before Christmas Eve that are observed by the churches that I've spoken of. They're called the first, second, third, and fourth Sundays of Advent. And those Sundays are significant for preparation for the gift of the Christ. Well, you're right, Joanna. I checked that out. And, you know, you have to give credit where credit's due, and you got the straight skinny on that one. I'm just a dumb Protestant, and so, you know, ask a Protestant, and he'd probably give you the wrong answer. So I thought I would correct that for all of you listeners out there. The 12 days of Christmas do not begin on the equinox, December the 21st. They do, in fact, start December the 24th through January the 6th. I got another letter in here, and he said, I got a question for you. How do you turn gold coins back into cash when banks won't deal in gold? And this comes from a listener named John. Well, you're right, John. The banks will not cash your gold back into cash. And that's because gold is cash. Take a look in any legal dictionary and you'll find that in the legal dictionary, cash, C-A-S-H, is gold or silver coin. So what is that stuff, that folding money that you've got in your pocket? Well, that's not cash. Those are called choses in action. So look up in the legal dictionary a chose in action. It's a right of recovery. It's something that you recover. So you want to recover your gold and silver. Well, in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt took our gold away. And in 1965, President Johnson took our silver away. So now we have, at least from 1964 to 1986, no gold or silver. However, you can't buy gold coin from the bank. They don't have any gold and they don't have any silver either. When you buy gold and silver, you have to buy it from a broker. Well, you could get it from a broker, a dealer, or a wholesaler. So let me tell you who the wholesalers are. At 10:30 in the morning, the Bank of England sets the price of gold coin. They just reach up and pull a number out of the air, and they tell us this is what the spot price of gold is, at least in London. And the spot price of gold is set in four locations: London, New York, Hong Kong, and San Francisco. So around the world at any given time, there's no two prices for the price of gold, spot price of gold, anywhere in the world. So, depending upon where you're the closest to and who you're buying and selling from, a wholesaler is a guy that takes the gold from the brokers and dealers, and he guarantees that price, whether the price is going up or going down. So when I call my broker and I say, I'm going to send you 5 ounces of gold, and he says, well, the price today is $430 an ounce, I say to my broker, lock in 430, and here comes the gold. Well, 3 days later, when my gold arrives at my broker's office, the price of gold may be $420. So my broker already locked in the price for me at $430, so he's going to pay me $430, and he's going to take the gold, and he's going to pass it on up to the wholesaler, who in turn is going to pass it on up to the Bank of England. And the only outfit in the world that could guarantee that price of $430, even though the price of gold went down $10, is the Bank of England, because you see, they just manufacture their own paper money, because the spot price of gold is measured in fiat paper currency all around the world. Now, that's not correct. God defined the price of gold in ounces of silver. So when he made this operation, he put into the earth's crust 17 ounces of silver for every ounce of gold. So the correct price for an ounce of gold is 17 ounces of silver, and the correct price for silver is 1 ounce of gold equals 17 ounces of silver. 17 ounces of silver equals 1 ounce of gold. So when we arrive at a price in dollars, euros, escudos, or rubles or something else, we are arbitrarily fixing a price based upon a banker's whim. We like to call it a market price, but the free market has very little to do with the price of gold and silver coin. It's a regulated monopoly is what it really boils down to. Now, when you want to buy some gold and silver, you go to your broker or your dealer. Now, a dealer is a coin store. The coin store is that guy that's listed in the yellow pages, and he says that he deals in coins. So you could go in there and buy Indian head pennies, or you could buy 20-cent pieces or 3-cent pieces or silver dollars, or you can buy and sell silver dollars. Gold and silver of various denominations, like maybe a 50-peso coin or Austrian coronas or something else. Then there's a guy called a broker. Now, a broker isn't listed in the yellow pages. You're not going to find him there. But they come in two varieties, these brokers do. They're private and public. So a public broker would be like Kitco. So you can go to kitco.com on the internet, and that's a public broker. Now, I don't deal very much with public brokers, but I have a couple of private brokers that I deal with. And the difference works like this. Kitco is a corporation, and they're regulated and controlled by the Interstate Commerce Commission. They're also more than likely public, and if they're public, well, then they're regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. They keep records and books and keep track of people's social security numbers and the trades that they make, and they have all these records and books. That's a public corporation, and they're regulated under a case called Hale versus Henkel. I like to do business privately under the Fourth Amendment, so I do business with a private broker, Frank and Charlie. And they don't do business with just anybody. They only do business with their own clientele. So they don't advertise in the yellow pages. You won't find them on radio or television advertising, you know, come to Charlie or Chuck or Frank and buy your gold and silver like you'll find Johnson Matthey or Englehart or Kitco or some of these public companies. They don't charge, that is, the private brokers don't charge sales tax. They don't need my social security number to make a trade. They're not regulated and controlled by the city council of various cities. They don't come under regulation like pawn shops and things like that. So a private broker comes under the Fourth Amendment, and he's a guy who actually charges less money. So a private broker will charge me somewhere between 2.5% to 4%. A dealer will charge me somewhere between 2.5% and 7% to 10%, depending upon the size of the transaction. And Kitco, they'll charge about the same, except that the trades aren't private. That is, that the government can know, the IRS can find out what my trades are, and I don't like that. So there's the story. If you want to buy and sell gold and silver, you get a broker. A broker is the cheapest way for you to buy and sell. Now, Franklin Sanders is a public broker. He puts out a newsletter. He's open to the public. He's a pretty good guy. I like him. I recommend him. And my private brokers I don't recommend because they won't do business with you anyway because they don't know you. So you can't do business with a private broker until he gets to know you. And that's kind of a word-of-mouth thing. You have to know somebody that knows somebody who can introduce you to a private broker so that you can get the better prices on trades. Again, the public brokers are Kitco and the money changer Franklin Sanders. All right, so there's the story on dollars and cents and gold and silver. Now, I got another letter in here, and this one kind of takes me to task a little bit on a program series that I did that deals with science. Let me read the letter to you, and then we'll take a look at this listener's complaints and see if we can answer his questions. He said, Dear Mr. Gordon, he said, first off, let me tell you how much I enjoy and appreciate your radio programs. He said, I listen to you regularly from the archives on your website. In your series, The First Star, you contrasted several preposterous scientific theories with the Genesis chapter of the Old Testament. While listening to you read from Genesis in that context, several questions came to mind. Specifically, what of the dinosaurs? Now, I'm not a proponent of the theory of evolution, but I believe the existence of dinosaurs to be rather a proven case. While the accuracy of the proposed timeliness is highly debatable, the claim that at one time dinosaurs roamed the earth is not. And additionally, there is significant evidence that indicates the dinosaurs existed and died off prior to man coming into the scene. And also, there is evidence that the earth underwent significant changes between the time of the dinosaurs and the time of man. Now, with that in mind, let's look at Genesis 1, verse 28, which states, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." What captures my interest, this listener goes on to say, is this passage, which contains the phrase, replenish the earth. The primary definition of the word replenish is to restock depleted items or material. Now, if this is the case, then it would suggest that the earth was at one point plenished, then deplenished, prior to the creation spoken of in Genesis. Furthermore, the reference that heaven and earth were created on the first day, in my mind, rules out the measurement of a day as being a 24-hour span of time. Well, at least for the first day. A day on earth is the measurement of time that it takes for the earth to make one full rotation on its axis. Since the creation time clock started ticking prior to the existence of the earth and the sun, then the measurement of a day would most likely reference some other span of time. Now, while you could postulate that a day is a day, and the earth was created to spin as such, it is arguable that the first day, and indeed all of the days, may have been considerably longer than 24 hours. Now, cutting to the chase, I find it plausible to suggest that there may have been multiple creations, as well as multiple creators, referring to the phrase, our image, in Genesis 1, verse 26. As an artist will paint one picture over the top of another one, perhaps we, along with our surroundings, are just the current rendition of what was deemed a good creation at the time. Now, I'd be very interested in your opinion on the possibility of multiple creations and how that would tie into the scientists' claim that the Earth is indeed billions of years old. Thank you for the time and effort and energy that you put into producing interesting and thought-provoking radio shows. You're one of the precious few people that provide the nourishment of common sense to a starving public. Well, on the one hand, I got castigated, and on the other hand, I got stroked. So I thank you very much, Mark, for your letter. And now let's see if we can go back over this story here and see if we can come up with a logical, plausible answer to these 9 questions. Mark asks for an answer to 9 questions, and so I wrote them out. Number 1, what of the dinosaurs? Number 2, dinosaurs existed. That's a proven case. And number 3, evidence of dinosaurs dying prior to man. Number 4, earth changes between dinosaurs and man. 5, replenish the earth. Number 6, one day equals 24 hours. Number 7, the time clock started ticking. Number 8, multiple creations. Number 9, multiple creators. So let's start up here at the top. Number 1, what of the dinosaurs? Well, evidently, in my series of programs, I must have left the listener with a concept or an idea, a belief, that I don't believe in dinosaurs. Now, that's not correct, and I didn't intend to leave anybody with that thought in mind. I'm fully familiar with dinosaurs, the dinosaurs that are on display, for instance, in the Chicago Natural History Museum, and I have a number of books on dinosaurs, and I'm fully familiar with, you know, T-Rex and Brontosaurus and Stegosaurus, and I say fully informed, or I'm aware of them. I'm not an expert, of course, on dinosaurs, no claim to be. And so let me dispense with or dispel any notion that I don't believe in the existence of dinosaurs, or that I don't think that dinosaurs are a proven case. They existed. I think there's a question as to, did these dinosaurs exist 65 million years ago, or did these dinosaurs exist 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago? Now, you've probably heard me from time to time in my ads use an ad that deals, for instance, with evolution. Let me give you an example of it. The sun is shrinking. A Newswire report of March 23, 1980 made the surprising statement, quote, "The sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. If the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. And 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been constant since the origin of the sun." So I asked the question, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? And then I went on to say, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on this kind of pseudo-scientific lie. So let's do a little arithmetic here. That's what I did. Scientists, physicists, and paleontologists, archaeologists, botanists and biologists and etc., all these various and sundry scientists of different disciplines, from what I can tell, don't seem to read the material of the other scientists. And when they don't, or if they're not aware of it, they make statements, and I'm going to presume that the statement, the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century, and that the sun is shrinking by 5 feet per hour. Now, I'll be the first guy to admit that I don't know how fast the sun is burning up. And there are government scientists, you know, the government spends a lot of money on science. They give money, let's say, to Harvard. They give money to these various and sundry universities, and then the universities pass these grants out to scientists, and then they go out here in their various disciplines and fields, and they study things. And then they write up reports, and then they send that in. I'm presuming that these scientists, when they get their equipment out and they measure how fast the sun is moving, I wouldn't have a clue as to how I would go about doing that. But I would presume that the people that take these grants from Harvard and these astrophysicists and the people that write articles for National Geographic probably know what they're talking about. I'm not doubting for a moment, you know, when some scientist comes in and he says, well, gee, we measured with a spectrometer, a spectrograph, the composition of this star out here. I presume that when he comes in, spectroscopic analysis has been proven in the laboratories here on planet Earth. So I don't doubt that. Science is an absolute. In fact, the word science means knowledge. And so I'm not quarreling with knowledge. What my quarrel is with speculation and philosophy. Speculation and philosophy. And I said, evolution is pure speculation and philosophy. It's a religion. It's not science. But it is presented to us based upon the premise that it is proven science, that this is the way it is. This is where the rubber meets the road. And I said, that's not true. So, just do the arithmetic on this, boys and girls. If it is true that the sun is shrinking by 5 feet an hour, and we didn't waste our money when we paid this scientist, whoever these scientists are that are measuring these events. Then they said in 100,000 years. Now, 100,000 years geologically isn't very long. You know, 65 million years ago is before man appeared on the Earth, the evolutionists tell us. And there weren't any mammals on the Earth. There were only lizards, dinosaurs, cold-blooded creatures. The mammals hadn't come about yet 65 million years ago. Now, this is their story. This is their argument. But here comes another scientist, and he's measuring the sun, and he says, gee, the sun is shrinking by 5 feet an hour. Now, they go on to say, well, it looks like the sun has been shrinking by 5 feet an hour for the last 65 million years. Now, this concept, you know, how do you know that the sun has been shrinking at 5 feet an hour for 65 million years, or 100,000 years, or 20 million years, or for the last 5,000 years? How do you know that? Nobody knows. It's a guess. We think that, and it's called uniformitarianism. We take a look at it today, and it's decreasing by 5 feet an hour. So we presume that it's always been decreasing by 5 feet an hour. That may be true or it may not be true. So let's suppose that the evolutionist is telling us the truth. I mean, this is his argument, not mine. So Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated them. So I'm telling you, the guy's name is Charles Lyell, and it's called uniformitarianism. He was a geologist, and he said, when you look at the Colorado River running through the Grand Canyon, you're not looking at a catastrophe like Noah's flood. You're looking at uniformitarianism, and what you see down there today is what's been going on for millions and millions and billions of years. And that at one time, that river was up here at the top, and now it's 5,000 feet down. It's a mile down into that hole called the Grand Canyon. That's what they tell you. That's their argument. Well, let's presume that their argument's correct. Let's just think about it. Okay, it's your argument, so you make it, Mr. Evolutionist. Now, that's called uniformitarianism. My argument is, I think there was a Noah's flood. I think the Grand Canyon was carved out in probably a year or less from Noah's flood, a worldwide flood that encompassed the entire world. I know, I'm kind of dumb, I'm kind of stupid, I'm ignorant, I'm one of these religious crackpots, but then, you know, it's what I believe. So now the evolution guy comes along, he says, well, Gordon, you're not scientific. You're dumb, a right-wing radical fanatic, a lunatic fringe. Believing such nonsense. So, okay. So now I take a look at uniformitarianism, and he says, well, uniformitarianism works with geology, it works with astronomy, it works with astrophysics, and it works with biology. And okay, this is your argument, Mr. Evolutionist, so go ahead and make it. Now, if this is true, and uniformitarianism is in fact true, accurate, and correct, and let's presume for the sake of our argument that it is, and the scientist measures the sun burning up at 5 feet an hour, we say, okay, well, that's probably true. We paid money to find that out, and we're going to believe you because you're telling us this. I don't know that. You don't know that, but we're going to believe it. Now, let's take their information and their arguments and see if it mathematically comes up. If the sun is burning up at 5 feet an hour, take 5 feet an hour and multiply that times 24 hours in a day. Then take that number and multiply that times 365 days in a year. And then you take that number and you multiply that times 100,000 years, 20 million years, and here's what the answer is. It'll tell you this answer. If the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, that totals 1% per 1,000 years, millennium, and if the sun existed just 100,000 years ago, it would be twice as big as it is today. Can you follow that? Now, the sun is about 750,000 miles in diameter. So if you took an orange and measured the diameter, it's the distance from the edge of it and out to the middle of it. Now, you take that number whatever it happens to be, 750,000 miles in diameter. That's the distance from one side over to the other side. You got a radius, then you got a diameter. And the diameter is that distance that goes through this orange. And the sun is going to be twice as big as it is today. I mean, you know, they look up there and they measure that. I don't know if the sun is 750,000 miles in diameter because I can't measure it. I don't know how. I haven't got a clue. It's not my argument. It's this evolutionist argument. He says that this thing is 750,000, about 750,000 miles through it to the other side, and that's the diameter of it. He says, now, if it's burning up at 5 feet an hour, 100,000 years ago, it would have been twice as big as it is today. Well, that doesn't hurt their argument too much until you go back 20 million years. Now, they tell us that the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago. 65 million years ago. And that if you were to take the sun, with what they're telling us, 5 feet an hour, multiply that out, in 20 million years, the sun would have been touching the earth. Now, the distance from the earth to the sun, they tell us, is 93 million miles. And again, I don't know how far it is to the sun. George Gordon's never measured it. I couldn't measure it. I haven't got a clue. I don't know if it's 93 million miles or 936 miles. I can't tell you. I don't know. But, you know, I went to the same school as you did, and all the books that I read told me it was about 93 million miles. So you take that 5 feet an hour. Now, I can do this. I've got my Texas Instruments calculator right here on my desk. And I can take the 5 feet an hour, and I can multiply that times 24, times 365, times 100,000, or times 20 million, and indeed it comes out to 93 million miles. Now look, not just 20 million years ago, a third of the time back to when the dinosaurs became extinct. The size of the sun, using uniformitarian geology as the basis, this is evolutionary philosophy at its best, then the sun would have been 93 million miles in diameter. And the earth, which is 93 million miles from the sun today, would have been right on the surface of the sun. And it's a good thing that the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago, because 20 million years ago they would have been burning up in the sun's atmosphere, wouldn't they? Now, can you see how stupid that is? That's why I say, you know, the astrophysicists and the biologists and the geologists should get together and get their story straight. So the dinosaurs didn't exist on this planet 20, 40, or 60 million years ago. That didn't happen. That's just a pseudo-scientific lie. These guys claim to be scientists, and then they feed that kind of crap to us. And, you know, I'm just a crummy plumber. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure out that that's just a bunch of crap. All right, let's take one more here. We got a thing over here that's called I'm trying to think of the name of this thing over here. I got erosion over here. It's the Earth's magnetic field. Magnetic field. Now, I can't measure the magnetic field. All I know is what I've read in the papers. You know, all I know is what you and I have all read in our science textbooks, our evolutionary textbooks. But everything that I've read in my lifetime tells me that our magnetic field is getting weaker and weaker. And I think this magnetic field has something to do with electricity. And that the electricity from the poles, and it's got some kind of, they picture the world, and it's got these concentric rings that go out from it, you know, and they call this magnetic field. I don't know what that is, and I don't know how it works, but I read the articles, and I passed my tests, you know, when I was in high school, and somehow or another I muddled my way through, and I got out of high school, and they got this thing called the magnetic field. So I have an awareness of something called the magnetic field. Now listen to this story. Charles Lyell, remember our hero, Charles Lyell? Now, he's a geologist, Charles Lyell is. I don't think he even knew that there was such a thing as a magnetic field. Now, maybe he did, I don't know, but it wasn't in his particular field of science. But Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology in the early 1800s. And remember, Lyell is the guy that came up with the idea that there are no catastrophes. There are no such things as Noah's flood and fire coming down from heaven and destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. That's just a fiction. That's just nonsense. That never happened. That's what he tells us. And that what you're witnessing today has been going on just like it has been today for millions of years. Now, I don't know how Charles Lyell knows that there wasn't a Noah's flood, that there haven't been catastrophes in the past. For instance, we just saw a pretty good-sized catastrophe in this tsunami over in the Indian Ocean, didn't we? Well, that was pretty good. And I was watching a nature program the other day, and they showed some scenes from Hawaii where they've got the evidence of a tidal wave that they said reached 1,600 feet up the side of a mountain in Hawaii on the coast. Now, this tidal wave that hit the Indian Ocean, I think, was, 30 feet high. Was that what it was? It wasn't 1,600 feet. It wasn't 600 feet. It wasn't 100 feet. It was 30 feet, and it killed a bunch of people, destroyed everything on the coast. So I would say that a tidal wave, that hits the side of a mountain and washes up there 1,600 feet, 1,200 feet in some places, was a catastrophe. That's not uniformitarianism. My common sense says that's catastrophism. This tidal wave that you see over there, that speaks to catastrophism. And a Krakatoa going off. You remember back in the 1880s, a volcano blew up, sent off a bunch of tidal waves, killed 30, 40,000 people. To my mind, that says catastrophe. That's not uniformitarianism. That's not, Kilauea dumping a little volcanic material out and building up, 3 or 4 acres a year, out in the ocean. Sounds like a catastrophe to me. Well, Lyell comes along and says, no, that's not true. There aren't any catastrophes. What we're talking about here is uniformitarianism. Now listen to this. A physicist by the name of Thomas Barnes points out that the Earth's magnetic field has been decaying regularly since it was first measured in 1835. Now, if the half-life of the magnetic field is truly what Dr. Barnes has shown from careful measurements, the conclusion is that the Earth's magnetic field would have been equal to that of a magnetic star as little as 10,000 years ago. So they talk about this thing called half-life. And every so many years, the magnetic field of the Earth is cut in half. Now, I don't know how many years that is. I've read some numbers. I don't know, say it's 150 years and it cuts in half, or 1,000 years it cuts in half. But every so many years, the force of the magnetic field is half what it was before. Well, if you just take the magnetic field today and double it, and you go back, whatever the doubling period is, and then you do that, 4 or 5 times, pretty soon the strength of the magnetic field 10,000 years ago would be equal to a magnetic star. Now, if there's no magnetic field, they tell us, life can't exist on this planet. And if the magnetic field gets to be like it is if there's a magnetic star, gravity will be so strong that we couldn't stand up, we couldn't live here. So this magnetic field, which is getting weaker and weaker, was stronger at some time in the past, but it wasn't as strong as a magnetic star 10,000 years ago, because they're telling us that 65 million years ago there were dinosaurs on the planet. Well, that wasn't possible. So that's why I say these scientists ought to get together and get their numbers squared around, because their story doesn't add up. And if we were in a courtroom and I just brought up these two cases here, the judge would dismiss. You can't prove a case with this kind of crap. That's nonsense. And you don't have to be a scientist. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. And so over the years, I've pointed that out to you. I probably have 20 of those here in my book, and I read those to you every once in a while and say, I think that the Mosaic Law, and I think the Bible, makes more sense than do these contradictory propositions that are being advanced in the name of science. And that's the problem with it. See, it's being proposed in the name of science here. So don't think that I don't believe in dinosaurs. I'm familiar with dinosaurs, and I believe in dinosaurs, but I don't believe there were dinosaurs here 65 million years ago. I think God created dinosaurs at the same time he created Adam and Eve, and that there were dinosaurs on the earth and went on to the ark with Noah, got off the ark with Noah, and have become extinct since then. And, you know, there's lots of animals that have become extinct since Noah took two of them on the boat. You know, saber-toothed tigers are extinct. Mammoths are extinct. There's lots of animals today, boys and girls, that we can see in the strata of the earth that were buried in Noah's flood. Now, every time you dig around in the strata and you find animals, doesn't that tell you that there was a big flood? There was a lot of water that buried these animals in that sediment, which later hardened into rock? I mean, isn't that a more logical story than for somebody to come along and tell you that the Colorado River isn't any bigger today than it was 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, or 10 million years ago? Same size. Now, I find that a little difficult to believe in light of just the arithmetic that goes along with the numbers that these scientists are giving to us. And I'm not adding these numbers in. I'm just telling you these are the numbers that the scientists, these evolutionary philosophers, are handing to me. And I say, okay, I've run your numbers through my machine and they don't add up. Now, that's the bottom line to that. All right, so that answers your questions there, number one, number two, on dinosaurs, John. So the next item over here, evidence of dinosaurs that they died prior to man. I don't know, John. What evidence do you have that dinosaurs died prior to the creation of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? I've heard the story. It's an evolutionary story. It's evolutionary philosophy. Let's analyze it for a minute. Let me ask you, John, were you there at the Garden of Eden when creation occurred? And are you offering your testimony here today, in your letter to me, are you offering your testimony in opposition to God? Do you know of any evolutionary philosophy, Bertrand Russell or Leakey or any of those guys, were they there? Do they know? You know of any scientists or anybody else that was here 65 million years ago that can testify that the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago? Well, we do have an affidavit. The Bible is an affidavit. It's an affidavit. It's a sworn statement by a testator. It's what's called the Old Testament and the New Testament. You got two sworn statements here. The guy that wrote the two statements over here said that he was going to swear by himself. And he said that because, in his words, he said, "There is none higher than me to swear by." Now today, when we go into court, we swear, we raise our hands and we swear by God Almighty that we're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, don't we? Well, God came into the picture and he said, well, I'm going to swear by myself too, because there's nobody higher than me to swear by. What was he going to swear by, you know? Are you going to swear by George Bush or swear by, you know, some guy here on the planet? And so he gave us a scenario here in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. That's what I went through in this series of programs, and I just read that chapter 1, and I said, well, here's what he told us. Now, it could well be, John, that God lied to us. I mean, I don't know. He says he's the God that cannot lie. He says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He says man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. I don't know if he's telling the truth or not. But I'm going to presume, just for the sake of the discussion, that he was telling the truth. You know, just for the sake of the argument. And he used the term, and the evening and the morning were the first day, and the evening and the morning were the second day, and the evening and the morning were the third day, and that he did these certain acts on these particular days. I wasn't there. I can't contradict him. Now, maybe you can contradict him. Maybe you've got some evidence that I don't have. Maybe you've got some knowledge that I haven't seen. I'm unable to contradict the statements made in Genesis 1 because I don't have any scientific evidence that would prove that that's incorrect. And I haven't seen anybody that has produced any evidence. And I read quite a bit. I get a lot of information and evidence that comes across my desk. And a little later on, I'm gonna cite some evidence from you, from some scientists that claim that they've got evidence and they know something. And the problem is that you get these scientists out here, and one of them says A, and the next one says B, and the third one says C, and I'm just a plumber, and I come along and say, well, I don't know if it's A, B, or C. And I'm unable to make that determination. So then the logical thing to do is to say, okay, well, A, bring forth your evidence, B, you bring forth your evidence, and C, you bring forth your evidence, and let me see who makes the most sense. And I just showed you here when we talk about 65 million years ago for dinosaurs, and you take a look at the magnetic field and the rate at which the sun is being consumed, 5 feet an hour, that if those numbers are correct, their story doesn't add up. And hell, they might be lying to us. Maybe the sun isn't burning up at the rate of 5 feet an hour. Maybe it's 10 feet an hour. Maybe it's 1 feet, 1 foot a year. Maybe it isn't 5 feet an hour. It's 1 foot a year. I don't know. Do you? You know, all I can do is tell you what this is what they're telling us. And that's what I read. And then they can't tell the same story twice. That tells me that their credibility isn't very good. Now, I read the Bible a time or ten. I didn't find any place in the Bible where God had contradicted himself. I've heard people say that this is a contradiction, but if you got some contradictions, bring them forth and let's analyze them. So the evidence that dinosaurs died prior to man is a speculation that's made by evolutionary philosophers based upon the same kind of faulty crap that they gave us on the sun, uniformitarian geology, and the magnetic field. Now, if they can't keep their story straight on those three, what in the hell makes you think that they've got their story straight when they say that there's evidence that the dinosaurs all died out prior to man? In fact, I'm going to show you some evidence that I think that man existed contemporaneously with the dinosaurs. And that's what the Bible tells us. Did you know that? Did you know that the scripture describes dinosaurs in the Bible, eyeball to eyeball, tells you what they look like, and that they were alive at the same time the patriarchs were alive? Now, of course, maybe God was lying again. Maybe Job and Daniel and all these guys, they're just a bunch of damn liars. But I don't have any evidence that Job was lying. He claims that he was an eyewitness. He said he saw it with his eyeballs. Now, I've read some history books, and when I read a history book, say, of the Civil War, and the author of the Civil War is quoting some general or somebody that was there on the battlefield, and he describes this event. For instance, I was at the Gettysburg battlefield. I took us up to a little round top, little hill over there. You know, it's not much of a mountain, just a little hill. And the guide over there and the stand down there that's got the little story said that that little creek, that little brook down at the bottom of Little Round Top, ran red with blood for 3 days after the battle, and that 6,000 men were scattered all over that hillside over there dead. Well, who am I to come along and say, oh no, they lied to us. There wasn't 6,000 men there. There was 60,000 there. The creek didn't run red for 3 days. It ran red for 9 days. Or the creek didn't run red with blood for more than 24 hours. I mean, who am I, George Gordon, to contradict the historicity of the site? I don't know. I wasn't there. Now, the story they're telling may be false. It may be true. I accept it as true because that's what they're telling me, and I didn't find anybody else that contradicted them. I've never read anybody that said that there wasn't 6,000 that died on the hillside. But oftentimes you do run across a contradiction. You know, somebody comes along and says, oh no, that's not true. And you find that in the Bible. One of the first things we saw in the Bible here in Genesis 2 was Satan came along and he said, hey, Eve, how come you ain't eating off that tree over there? And she said, well, that's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God said that in the day that we eat off of that, we'll surely die. And Satan contradicted God right there, and he says, oh, no, God knows better than that. He knows that that tree is desirable to get real smart real fast, and that if you eat off of that, you're gonna wise up. Eve said that she saw that it was good for food, and so she ate off the tree. And you want to know something? John, she didn't die. Now, the scripture said that she was told that in the day that you eat off of that tree, you will die. Eve went over there and ate off the tree, and she did not die. So she could see that God had, in fact, past tense, lied to her. You know, from her vantage point in life, she didn't know what death was. She hadn't seen it yet. She hadn't died. Adam hadn't died. Death, the scripture says, hadn't entered into the world yet. And so they didn't know what it was, but they were told that that's what was going to happen to them, whatever this thing called death was that was going to happen to them. She ate off the tree, and whatever this bad thing was, she couldn't tell any difference. But she could tell that she could get real smart real fast, and she looked down and says, "Oh my God, I'm naked." And you know, Satan told her, he said, you know, in the day that you eat off that tree, you're going to get real smart real fast. And she could see that Satan told her the truth. She got real smart real fast. And she could see that God lied to her because she didn't die. Let me ask you this, John. Is Eve alive on planet Earth today? Well, if she is, she's hiding someplace because I think she died a long time ago. Now, the scripture says that Adam died. He was 930 years old. Now, oftentimes when we look at a word, if it's in English, it has more than one meaning. Sometimes a phrase has a duality to it. Now, take a look at the phrase that says, "In the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die." It has two meanings. Let's suppose that she ate off the tree on June 19th. I just pick a date. She didn't die on June 19th. She died 900 years later. The statement that says, "In the day that you eat thereof, comma, thou shalt surely die." And sure enough, we look back today, and that woman, sure enough, surely died. Who was telling the truth? Now, it also has a second meaning. "In the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die." Now, it either meant that you're going to die on the very day, that is June 19th, when you eat off that tree, or on June 19th, when you eat off of that tree, at some future date, you are surely going to die. And, you know, one thing I can tell you, you know, I'm 65 years old, and I'm pretty well convinced that at some point in time, I'm going to die. Now, the scripture said the wages of sin is death, and I've been a sinner, and I'm pretty sure that I'm going to die. Hadn't happened yet, but, you know, one of these days, old George is going to be toast. So I think God told Eve the truth, and I think Satan lied to her. And I think he was pretty crafty in the way he did it, because, you know, in reality, Satan told Eve the truth. He just didn't tell her the whole truth. Which is just another methodology for deception. He said, "In the day that you eat off of it, you will not surely die, and you'll get real smart." And by God, he was right. In the day she ate it, June 19th, she didn't die, and she got real smart. He told her the truth. But he didn't tell her the whole story. He didn't go on to say, well, you know, what God is referring to here is that you're going to die 900 years from now. You're going to be toast. So let's keep that one in mind as we analyze this concept of evolutionary philosophy and whether or not, you know, these are 24-hour days or they're 1,000-year days or the gap theory is correct or maybe the direct testimony of an eyewitness maybe is better evidence than the theories and postulates and the speculations that come. So if you believe that dinosaurs existed before man, that's fine with me. I'm not going to take issue with you. I mean, after all, that's a belief, you know. People have beliefs. But science isn't predicated upon beliefs. Science is predicated upon facts. Facts that are duplicatable. Independently triable by somebody else. And I don't know of anybody that can independently demonstrate that the dinosaurs died out prior to man. I don't know of any evidence that can tell you or tell me that these dinosaurs were in existence prior to man. I don't see that in the scripture. If you do, well, then that's what you see. I didn't see that, and I don't believe it. But I could be wrong, and you could be right. But both of us aren't right. One of us is wrong. You're wrong, or I'm wrong, one or the other. So that takes care of number three. All right? Evidence. Dinosaurs died prior to man. Well, in the book of Job, it talks about a critter called a behemoth. So why don't you look up the word behemoth and the word leviathan, whose tails are like trees. Now, you take a look at an elephant. They're a pretty big critter. Pretty big animal. And you take a look at a giraffe. He's a pretty good-sized critter. You take a look at a rhinoceros and a hippopotamus. They're all pretty big animals. Now take a look at their tails. Their tails are all small. Now go take a look at a dinosaur. And the dinosaurs all have big tails, don't they? And in the book of Job, it describes behemoth as having a tail like a tree. We're not talking about some critter over here that's an elephant or a mammoth. We're talking about some kind of a critter that has a tail like a tree, and the dinosaurs have great big tails. Tails like trees. And an elephant has a tail like a reed of grass. So again, you know, believe what you want, but it looks like to me that the scripture is describing a leviathan, which is a critter that's in the ocean or in water, and a behemoth, which is a land creature over here. And it looks like to me that Noah's description, or God's description of Noah and the ark prior to the flood in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 is pretty accurate, pretty scientific. You know, you look at the Grand Canyon, and you look at a worldwide flood, and you look at the volume of water in a worldwide flood. Now, I'm from a floodplain in the Eel River Valley, and I've seen the river come through there and just change the course of the river's channel by just wiping out several hundred acres of land and just cutting the river through a new piece of real estate. And that's really small by comparison. I mean, that's not a worldwide flood. That's just a flood that's, you know, 10 feet deep, 15 feet deep max. And all of a sudden, we find out that, hey, water's got a lot of power. And when you look at a hole a mile deep in the earth being carved out by a river that they tell us is carving that out at the rate of 1 inch every 100 years, that's the number I saw, 1 inch every 100 years, I'd say, well, just add up a mile and take an inch every 100 years and multiply that back, and it's more than 10,000 years, and the earth would be a magnetic star. No, I think that thing had to have been dug out a little faster than that, John. I mean, my common sense tells me that based upon what these evolutionary scientists tell me. Well, I'm out of time here. We got to take this up next time, John. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about this thing of evolution. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, there's a signal. It says my time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.